Good morning, everybody. Good to see everyone this morning. We are in a series that we started on Easter Sunday called Rise. And what we're doing in this series is reflecting on the fact that when Jesus rose from the dead, it was not just an historical event that happened a long time ago, but that it set in motion a power that affects you and me even today as we follow Him. And that is the power to rise, rise above, move through the challenges that come to us. And there is very little that we're discussing in this series that doesn't rely, at least in part, on what we're going to cover this morning. Escaping our past, healing our wounds, breaking old patterns, they will all be essentially impossible if we don't apply ourselves earnestly to the subject we're tackling this morning. I'm talking about forgiveness. Forgiveness. Let me state the obvious, and for us human beings, really, the painfully obvious. You can't rise above what you never get over. That the altitude of the life we live will be determined by the grace we can give. That there's a ceiling of unforgiveness, and when we face something in our lives that we need to forgive, someone, something that we need to forgive, until we can find a way to move through that and find the path of forgiveness, we will hit a ceiling in our rising, and we will not rise above what we cannot get over. I've come to believe strongly that forgiveness is something we learn. We have to apply ourselves to it, like a subject in school. We must learn the components of forgiveness, the principles, the dynamics, the functions, the very physics of it, the language and grammar and pronunciation of it, the how of forgiveness. We have to practice it like one practices a musical instrument or your golf swing or long division. We have to move through it, learn it, master it. And we all have to learn it. Because we all face pain, and we all face injustice. Throughout this series, we're hearing the stories of Outlookers. So far, all of them have been ministers on our staff, and we've done that purposefully to reflect that pain and injustice and trial come to all of us. No one's exempt. Life is a mess sometimes, right? And we move through it with the help of Christ. And so this morning, I've asked Melissa Jakes to come and share a portion of her story with us and how it reflects on the value of forgiveness. So let's welcome Melissa to the podium this morning. Thank you, Melissa.
Well, in a way, my lessons in forgiveness began before I was born. My 19-year-old mother found herself pregnant by a man who did not want to marry her. Her high school sweetheart offered to marry her, and she agreed. And that's who I will call my adoptive dad. My mom and my adoptive dad had a very troubled marriage. They divorced, remarried, and divorced again by the time I was 2 or 3. He had really tried to do a good thing, but he just wasn't ready to have a family yet. He dropped out of my life until I was about 5. Then he was dating a woman who loved kids and wanted to meet me and spend time with me. He went along with it, but was still very disconnected emotionally from me for most of my childhood. My mom told me about my biological father when I was in elementary school. I only ever met him a handful of times, and that was just about 4 years ago. He confessed to me then that he had abandoned both of us because of his addiction to alcohol. My mother remarried when I was about 4. He was an abrasive man who already had 2 sons and didn't like little girls very much. He was threatening, legalistic, and enjoyed putting people down while laughing like it was a joke. Many times through the years, I felt unloved, unwanted, and humiliated. As a young girl of about 13, when my mom wasn't around, he backed me into a corner and told me that if I ever got pregnant while I was living there, that I would be kicked out of the house. Growing up, I never heard any of my parents say, "I love you," and the only one who ever hugged me was my stepmom. When I was 14, I asked to go and live with her and my adoptive dad. Miraculously, my mom allowed that and let me move there. That summer, before my freshman year, I met an 18-year-old guy at a 4th of July party. Because I was so starved for acceptance and affection, this guy preyed on me, knowing that I was only 14, got me alone, and raped me. I couldn't tell anyone, though. My mom and stepmom probably would have wanted to know, but I knew I couldn't trust their husbands. I didn't even realize how bad all of this was until I had already married and my first child was born, and then it hit me like a tidal wave. I had married a man with some similarities to my stepdad, so it was very easy to direct my anger at him. And while there were definitely legitimate things to be angry with my first husband about, I lumped all of my hurts and anger together because there was a lot to forgive. While Chanel was still very young, I finally developed a real relationship with God. I experienced His forgiveness through Jesus as I studied the Bible and believed that He loved me unconditionally. I would say the single most important way that Jesus helped me rise was through His forgiveness and acceptance of me. To follow Jesus, I must forgive others even while they are still sinners, because that's exactly what He did for me. Because of Jesus, I also realized that my Heavenly Father wasn't going to abandon me, even though I wasn't perfect. All I felt was love and acceptance from Him and genuine encouragement to improve. He truly wanted only the very best for me, but He would never humiliate or manipulate me into anything. He was very different from my earthly fathers. Another very important way that Jesus helped me rise was giving me a genuinely Christ-like man named Jim to be my husband. And also by surrounding me with men who are authentic Jesus followers right here at Outlook. Now, whenever I get angry and need to forgive, I remember how much my real Father loves me, and those thoughts deflate my anger. I remember that God wants to be close to me, even though I'm not perfect, and also how much I've been forgiven, which is quite a lot.
Many thanks to Melissa for having the courage to share those chapters of her story with us, and I know she's far from alone in facing similar circumstances. We all face things and have faced things that require us to tackle the subject of forgiveness. It's a complex one, one that we could spend a lot of time on, and we only have a certain amount of time together this morning. Biblically speaking, forgiveness means things like this. It means resisting revenge. It means not returning evil for evil. It means breaking what I would call the cycle of deservedness. You know, we can easily get kind of trapped in this cycle of feeling like we didn't get what we deserved, and maybe we're out to then give others what they deserve when they hurt us. But Jesus says to love your enemies, to do good to those who hurt you, that we break, we're people who break that cycle. We don't get stuck in that cycle. Forgiveness includes things like grieving at the calamities of those who've hurt us. Don't gloat, Proverbs says, when your enemy falls. Now, can we all just come clean and say, that's hard to do? It is easy to gloat when someone who's hurt you is themselves coming on a hard time. Because, you know, you just kind of want to get a little self-righteous for a second. They really had it coming to them. They're getting what they deserve. But we're falling back into that cycle of deservedness. And when in moments like that, what I would challenge us to do is to, as we break that cycle by caring more about the person we are becoming. Do I really want to be the person, the kind of person, who smirks with satisfaction when someone else is hurt, no matter who they are? Is that really who I want to be? Is that how I want to live in front and before my God? who knows me and loves me. So we've forgotten, I think, many times how to be people who care more about what's going on in our own heart and character than maybe just what someone deserves or what's right or what we think is right. So don't gloat when your enemy falls, it says. Don't let your heart rejoice. Forgiveness also includes praying for those and their, who've hurt us, for praying for their welfare, wanting good things for them. Chances are really good that the people who hurt us because they themselves are hurting. They've got some stuff that needs to happen in their lives too. So we can pray good things for them. And that in no way has to diminish our own healing. In fact, it will help it. We can also come to their aid when possible. Now, there's a lot of stuff there. We could spend all morning just on those. But I'm going to spend our time, think it will be better spent, covering what I found to be the three huge limiting factors for all of us when we come to this subject of forgiveness. We see the truths that we'll look at today repeatedly in Scripture. And so these three areas, these three snags, these three ceilings, limiting factors, I want to spend some time, it's like diagnosing the catch in your golf swing or tutoring us in the function that we just can't get past and we can't move on in algebra. These are the things that when it comes to the subject of forgiveness, it's hard for all of us. But let's give them a little thought and reflect on them this morning. Because we'll only rise above what we can get over. And we will go no farther than what we can't get past. So let's examine these limiting factors. Here's the first one. The first one is how we interpret the situation around us. Because forgiving doesn't change our circumstances, but it does change us and our perspective of our circumstances. See, this can be a really confusing part of forgiveness. Something has happened. We are wounded, we are hurt, some injustice has occurred, whatever it might be, and the situation is around us, it has its own effects, whatever those might be. And we know, as Jesus followers, that we're called to put ourselves on a path of forgiveness, but the circumstances, and sometimes the people around us who are involved, they aren't changing. The effects continue. The memories remain. And it can be confusing, because somewhere in there, we've kind of linked forgiveness to resolution. That if I'm forgiving, things should get better. But it doesn't always happen that way. In fact, rarely does it ever really happen exactly that way. So we're trying to interpret our circumstances and we're confused. And then we're wondering, am I being forgiving? Am I doing this right? But what we'll find is, as we lean into grace and become people who give it, we will find contentment there. Paul said to the Philippians, I've learned to be content, whatever the circumstances. He knew that our power to change the circumstances around us is pretty limited. But what we really needed to do was learn the lesson of contentment regardless of our circumstances. To the Thessalonians, he said, give thanks in all circumstances. That's God's will for you. So he doesn't talk about how to change your circumstances. He talks about how to be changed in your circumstances. And nowhere is this more applicable than when we're moving through the circumstances that require forgiveness. See, somewhere along the line, we've picked up the idea that we should deny the reality of the situation. Forgive and forget, we're told. And it puts us under a false pressure. Now, forgiveness can sometimes yield eventual forgetfulness, right? It comes to your mind less and less. Maybe over time it's as if it never happened. Maybe not. Forgiving can lead to forgetting, but it doesn't start there. In fact, Lewis Smedes writes very insightfully about this, and I want to quote him. He says, you need to forgive precisely because you've not forgotten what someone did. Forgetting, in fact, may be a dangerous way to, check this, escape the inner surgery of the heart that we call forgiving. If we just quickly dismiss, it's okay, it's no big deal, and we just want to move past what someone's done to us, what's happened to us, the wounds that we're experiencing and the injustice that we're facing, if we just want to kind of skirt right past that because we think that's just what we're supposed to do, just forgive and forget, we could be bypassing some very deep work that needs to happen in us. He calls it inner surgery of the heart. That's what forgiving, the act of forgiving, really is. The first and often only person, he says, to be healed by forgiveness is the person who does the forgiving. And let's face it, some things are, frankly, unforgettable. One may burn down a house, either by arson or by accident, but in any case, it is nonsense to say that the house is still there or that you don't remember how good it was to live in it. Denying reality is not ever what Jesus calls us to do. In fact, he always calls us to lean into and embrace reality, but with his faith-filled perspective. Better than the false pressure to forget is the true virtue of contentment that redemption brings. See, God infuses our situation with this special sauce that he's got, right? It's called redemption. He's good at something. He's good at taking these messed up circumstances and somehow, even though he didn't cause them and wouldn't have wanted them to be, he is expert at somehow taking them and redeeming them and turning them into something that if we let him, will make us better people, wiser people, stronger people, and he will weave them together into something that we could have never imagined, something good. Good things will grow from the ashes of that fire if we'll let God do his work. But that work does not happen in denial. And, no big deal, just forget it. That's denial, and that's not what Jesus calls us to, but acceptance. This happened. I'm absorbing it. I'm embracing it. I'm moving into it. I'm leaning into Jesus and asking him to walk with me through these things, not pretending they didn't happen. In one of the most profound stories of betrayal and forgiveness, I'm talking about the story of Joseph at the end of the book of Genesis. We'll talk more about it next week, but there's this great line in which Joseph confronts his brothers who sold him into slavery years before, and they haven't seen him since, and now he's there in Egypt, and they're there, and Joseph's been elevated to this high command in the country, and he's saving everyone from famine by the wisdom that God has given him, and his brothers are there, and they're sorry for what they've done after all these years, and this is what Joseph says, "As for you, you meant evil against me." He's not denying that. What you did was wrong, and it was wrong-hearted. You wanted to hurt me, and you did. But God meant it for good, to bring about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. He's saying, I'm interpreting the situation differently. You hurt me, but God used it, leveraged it to do something good. How we interpret our situations and looking for the good, as I said, we'll talk more about that next week. But this is our first limiting factor. Am I forgiving? Am I doing it right? Because you know what? Things around me haven't changed. And I want to just try to lift that factor off of us and realize they may not change, but will you change? That's the true work of forgiveness. Here's the second limiting factor. It's how we understand our emotions. Because forgiving doesn't neutralize our emotions, but it does leverage them for our growth. We're in the middle of that trial. We're trying to figure out, as faithful Jesus followers, man, I want to forgive. Jesus calls me to forgive. How do I do this? And how am I supposed to feel about this? Because, man, my emotions are strong, right? Anger, hurt, resentment, bitterness, they're there. And then we ask, well, have I forgiven? Am I doing this right? I can't always tell. But I will say that as you lean into grace, not only will it bring contentment in the circumstance, it will bring peace to your emotions. But it will take some time. We ask the question, how do I know if I've forgiven? And the best way I know to describe it is this. You'll feel it in the muscles in your chest. You'll feel it in the muscles in your forehead, right? The tension. Am I releasing or am I hanging on and holding over? And if we can quiet ourselves for a moment and really reflect on what's happening in us, and that's not always an easy thing to do, but if we can and ask Jesus to help us and really start to just ask, what's going on inside me? We'll sense it. Am I in a posture that's moving toward, at least, releasing? Or man, am I in a posture of hanging on and then holding it over that person or those persons? Wounds will remain. Circumstances may be even permanently damaged. But the real test will be when that person moves in and out of our lives, if they're physically around, or in and out of our minds as we think of them, or hear of them, or simply remember them, as they move into our consciousness. What happens in us? Are we releasing? Or are we hanging on? And then do we just want to hold that over them? That when we think of them, we only think of what they did to us. That's holding it over. And it's natural, but it's no place to stay. And so, as we deal with our emotions, it's all about, forgiveness is all about letting those things be released. In Ephesians, we read, "In your anger, do not sin." And when we're moving through a trial that requires forgiveness, these are important words. Anger is a normal response to being injured or witnessing injustice. Anger is not a sin. Anger is emotion. Anger is not a sign of immature Christian character. It's not a sign of weakness. But as one author I read put it, it is a sign you have a pulse, right? To be angry is to be human, and there are plenty of things in this world that are worthy of our anger. It happens, and it should happen. But we do recognize, and there's a reason Paul makes a point of these of saying this, as we see it here. We must be careful with our anger, because we are on the threshold. In moments of anger, we are on the threshold of lots of potential sin, right? Hurting others, saying things we shouldn't, doing things that will only injure others. Anger will lead us there, so we have to be careful with it. But in and of itself, it is not a sin. I like the way Frederick Buechner writes about this idea of anger and just how tempting it can be to live in it. He says, of the seven deadly sins, anger is probably the most fun. He says, to lick your wounds, to smack your lips over grievances long past, to roll over your tongue the prospect of bitter confrontations still to come, to savor to the last toothsome morsel both the pain you are given and the pain you are giving back. In many ways, it is a feast fit for a king. The chief drawback is that what you are wolfing down is yourself. The skeleton at the feast is you. That's what happens when we choose to live in unforgiveness. We are eating ourselves alive. We're wasting our time, our emotions, our mental energy, rehearsing, practicing, going over how wronged we were, how wrong they are, and we're letting our life slip right by. When we refuse to put ourselves on the path of forgiveness, the person we're injuring is ourselves. We will not rise above what we refuse to get over. And as assuredly as anything else in our lives, unforgiveness will stunt our growth in every way, personally, spiritually, psychologically, you name it. You get stuck in unforgiveness, you are stuck and will not grow as a human being. It will be the cap that keeps you where you are. I've always appreciated these verses from Proverbs about patience and absorbing an offense. Better a patient person than a warrior, right? Instead of going out and fighting and being angry, be patient, one with self-control than one who takes a city. A person's wisdom yields patience. Check this. It is to one's glory to overlook an offense. That a real test of our character will not be how we react, but how we absorb the offense of another. How we lean into the punch, take the hurt, and become the kind of person who has the inner resilience to overcome hurt and not just want to fight back, get angry, and then get even. We have to take that seriously. Like I said, we have to be people who care about who we are, regardless of how anyone else acts or treats us. That we have to know that no matter what happens around me or the choices anyone else makes, I've still got to make my choices. I'm still putting one foot in front of the other, moving through my mornings and afternoons and evenings, trying to string one day in another into another. I've got to make those choices myself, and no one will make them for me. So we take that seriously. Often we pay closer attention to the state of our 401k than to the state of our soul. We take better and more care of our car than our character. But maybe we need a tune-up. Maybe we need some soul maintenance. Forgiveness and moving through the trials that require forgiveness will put us through those diagnostics more clearly and efficiently and deeply than anything else. In Colossians 3, we read that as God's chosen people, holy and dearly loved, we should clothe ourselves with compassion and kindness and humility and gentleness. And there it is again, patience. See, these are virtues we choose to put on. They don't just miraculously grow without our cooperation in us. We lean toward them. We choose to become more like that. And the Spirit is there then to help us do that. And so when we're moving through something that needs forgiven, it's putting on those clothes of compassion and patience and kindness and humility that will serve us very, very well. I have to admit, I rarely find forgiving easy or even completely satisfying, right? Injustices, man, they nag at me. I still feel pain. Too often, I end up having to approach God about the same thing again and again. Yielding and then yielding again. Things I thought I'd given over to him long ago, but you know what? Mine. Again. I'm going to take that back. I want to think about that some more. I want to consider that again. Chew on that a little bit more. Maybe sharpen my knives of revenge. And then I realize, no, that can't be who I'm going to become. Maybe you can relate to that. Forgiveness takes time. It's a process. So many times I talk to people who've encountered hurt, injury, betrayal of some kind, and then in addition to that pain, they also lay on the shame of not feeling as though they've forgiven. But forgiveness is a path, and I think that's the best way to consider it. At any single point on that path, you may ask yourselves, have I completely forgiven that person? And that can be sometimes a tough question to answer, and maybe it's not the best first question. It's a goal, but also realize, but am I on the path of forgiveness? Do I want to completely forgive that person? Not only because Jesus asks me to, but because it's who I want to become. And if the answer to that question is yes, then the next question is simply, well, then what do I do next about that? Instead of feeling guilty that we're not at 100% forgiveness instantly, am I on the path of forgiveness? Am I doing the things that forgive that will yield forgiveness? And that doesn't mean that we're saying that what someone did was wrong, wasn't wrong. Doesn't mean that we're denying that we have wounds that need to be healed. Doesn't even mean that there's not a permanent change in the relationship. But what it does mean is when it comes to that other person, I am setting you free. You owe me nothing. I'm no longer holding that over you. In fact, I'm going to take it on myself. Jesus and I will move through this. You are free. And that takes us to our third limiting factor, and maybe the toughest one of all, how we approach our relationships. Forgiving doesn't reconcile all our relationships, but it does provide an essential starting point. This can be tough to absorb, tough to figure out. We know what doesn't work, right? Resentment doesn't work. Grudges don't work. The silent treatment doesn't work. Give up your right to be right. Because, spoiler alert, it doesn't really exist, right? We don't have the right to be right. We're all wrong. Can we say that out loud together? We're all wrong. Now, we might not be wrong in every situation, but we've all been wrong, and we're all going to be wrong. And so when someone's been wrong to us, it just means they're more like us than we care to admit. We have to find the path of forgiveness, make a way for repentance, perhaps even build a bridge to reconciliation, because grace brings love. Romans 12 says, "Don't repay anyone evil for evil. Be careful Again, this is something we apply ourselves to. It doesn't happen by accident. Be careful to do what is right in the eyes of everyone. And if it's possible, as far as it depends on you, live at peace with everyone. Do what you can, not what you can't. There's all kinds of stuff you can't control, but what you can do, you should do when it means to living at peace and in love with others. It's not minimizing what someone has done. In fact, it's more costly than that. Forgiveness says, you hurt me deeply, but I'm not going to make you pay. I will pay. Forgiveness doesn't mean pretending that nobody did anything wrong or just learning how to be civil in public settings to those who've hurt us. Forgiveness means that the consequences aren't up to me, and I finally realize that I'm not going to try to make this right by getting even with you or just rehearsing in my mind how much you've wronged me. I won't let myself get trapped into thinking that the consequences are up to me. They are not. So I'm going to let it go. Colossians 3 says, bear with each other and forgive one another. If any of you has a grievance against someone, forgive as the Lord forgave you. That has to be our aim, the path we put ourselves on. Perhaps we can reconcile with the person or persons who hurt us. But hear this, forgiveness and reconciliation are not synonymous. Friendship is not necessarily a byproduct of forgiveness. It can be, and it will only happen if forgiveness takes place. There is no reconciliation that does not start with forgiveness. Forgiveness doesn't look the same in each situation. In one relationship, it can mean boundaries and distance because wisdom dictates that. In another, it can mean full reconciliation and restored closeness. But I don't want anyone living under the shame or condemnation that says, because reconciliation didn't or hasn't yet occurred, something's wrong with you or the practice, your practice of forgiveness. God knows the way that you take. And we'll do this forgiving thing awfully imperfectly. But are you on the path aimed toward forgiveness? And are you progressing on that path? That's what counts. You will get there. Jesus will take you there. So we've talked about a lot of stuff this morning, and it's just a fraction of all that we could have. But I hope by just identifying these three limiting factors, we've maybe learned a little something that will help us move through the need to forgive. It doesn't change our circumstances, but it does change us. It doesn't neutralize our emotions, but it can leverage them for our growth. It doesn't reconcile all our relationships, but it does provide a starting point we all need. Because I want you to rise, to grow, to mature, but we will not rise above what we cannot get over. And Jesus knows that we must. Let's pray about that.